Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 2nd, 2005. This session, Climate Change Beyond the Day After Tomorrow and State of Fear, presented in the Fireside Room by Philip Moat. Disc number MOP-2005-02. Let's listen in.
Watch, it's time, so thank you all for coming this morning. Yesterday, I kicked off this series on global environmental challenges and their solutions, and today we turn to probably the biggest global environmental challenge, which is global climate change. And this, if you ever hear anything about it in the media, you probably know that this is a topic that has riled up a lot of people, and often the science of what we really understand is not very well presented in the media. Now, I think in the last 5 years, a lot of print reporters have done a much better job at conveying what we know and what we don't know. But what the title of this talk today is Beyond the Day After Tomorrow and State of Fear, which are two sort of fictional examples of what climate change is about. So go ahead, Nat, and let me all introduce you to my son, Nat, upstairs, who's running the computer. So this is the outline for the week. Yesterday we talked about learning global stewardship beyond just the local environmental problems to some larger scale problems, acid rain and ozone depletion, and the lessons learned from that. And today, we're going to sort of go over the science of climate change, and then tomorrow I will talk about climate change and the world's poor. We'll discuss the impacts of climate change and some of the moral and ethical issues that arise. And then on Thursday we'll talk about the United States and climate change, both the political view and also what's happening in terms of actual actions. And a friend of mine, Steve Jones, who is in our church in Seattle, will be contributing. He's an expert on the wind industry, so he's going to say a little bit about what's happening in the wind industry on Thursday. And then finally on Friday, we'll talk about species extinctions, which I call undoing God's creation. So just a quick recap of some of the things we talked about yesterday. First, as we look through the Bible at themes about stewardship of creation, the first thing we see is that God created nature and gave it a purpose. It has intrinsic goodness, and it also has a function in sustaining us as humans. Second, God gave authority over the created world to humankind, and with that came responsibilities as well as privileges. Because God retains title to the created world, so we are not the owners, but merely the stewards. Finally, another theme that emerges is that the created world suffers because of human sin and will share in redemption. And this all affects the way Christians, at least I believe, it affects the way Christians should think about these global environmental issues and our role in solving them. There are some implications, I think. First is that we have a responsibility to keep creation in good working order, and we'll begin to see, as we talk about global climate change, the ways in which this aspect is important. Second, this notion of justice between nations and between generations, and this too will begin to emerge as we discuss global climate change, because of the disconnect, both in space and time, between those responsible for what's happening and those who suffer most. And finally, I think it's pretty clear that amid the whole role of players on this topic, the people of God have special obligations and special perspectives. So let's, but before we get into what the science of climate change says, I want to lay out what the basis for the science of climate change is. So the first thing to understand is that in any scientific field of endeavor, the currency or the basic foundation is the collection of peer-reviewed scientific papers. You look at data, you analyze it, you write a paper describing what you've done, you submit it to a journal, and then somewhere between 2 and 6 anonymous experts will review it and say, well, you did this equation wrong, or this looks good, but you should have used this other data set. So there's this quality test that has to be passed in order to get papers into the literature. And these papers by themselves may not present, in fact, none of them will present a complete picture of a big complicated topic like this. You can think of each one as sort of like a brick. And bricks by themselves, you know, there was a fellow right outside as we walked in knocking the edges off stones to fit them together. And that's sometimes what you have to do to piece together all of these different papers. And this job of putting them together, putting together all the little bits of knowledge, is sort of like building, say, a brick schoolhouse out of these bricks. You have to kind of knock off the edges in some places. And fortunately, for this very big, complicated subject, there is an international effort overseen by the United Nations and the World Meteorological Organization, which is known as the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Now, if panel makes you think of a group of 6 or 8 people sitting in a room, that's really not what the IPCC is. The main body is a group of people, each appointed by one of the 170 plus member nations of the UN, and they oversee the scientific writing process. The scientific writing process has produced 3 major reports. Work is currently underway for a 4th assessment report that will be out, that will come out in 2007. And to give you an idea of the level of effort involved, I'm fortunate to be part of the writing team on this 4th assessment. We met last September and then produced what we called a zero order draft in the fall, where we sort of outlined what we were going to say and pulled together some key figures, and then just sent it around for internal review with a few dozen experts on each subject. There are a total of 12 chapters and about 150 people involved in the primary writing, but there are also another 150 contributing authors. So there are about 300 people writing this document. At the end of next week, we have to submit this thing for formal peer review. So we've just finished revising it a second time, and it will go out for peer review. We'll get comments in the winter, and we'll spend a few months revising in response to that, and then it goes out for peer review again. So it's this very elaborate process to make sure, number one, that we're distilling the science correctly, and number two, that we're telling the story completely and accurately. The reason I'm going into all this detail is that you can go on the internet or go to a newspaper or whatever, and you can find little bits and perspectives on climate change, but there is no way that any one person or any one website can be as complete and authoritative as the IPCC because of this huge process. So there's a huge weight of authority in the understanding brought by this expert community. Let me just give you the 2 most important summary statements that came out of the 3rd assessment report in 2001. By the way, just to give you a sense of the scale of this thing, the third assessment report was 894 pages, and I read every word of it. It took me a few months, sort of picking away at it a few hours a week, but I thought it was important to read the whole thing. For the next one, we're aiming for something that's a little shorter, only about 600 pages. But the major conclusions of the 3rd assessment report were: an increasing body of observations gives a collective picture of a warming world and other changes in the climate system. In other words, yes, the climate really is changing. Okay, that's the first very important conclusion. Second, there's new and stronger evidence that most of the warming observed over the last 50 years is attributable to human activities. So we can no longer just dismiss it as, oh, well, it's mostly natural or it's all natural. So I'm going to show you a bit of the evidence on these 2 points. One participant in crafting this summary statement referred to the previous version in the second assessment report, which said, considering all the uncertainties, the balance of evidence suggests a discernible human influence on global climate, which you can see is a lot more nuanced. And this participant referred to that as the triple squishy, because it had three words of sort of weaseling out. The only weaselly word here is most. And that's not a very weaselly word. So as the scientific community is trying very hard to state very clearly that we are seeing an unnatural change in the planet's climate. Well, there are, of course, alternative views. Michael Crichton, well known for creating the TV series ER, as well as the movies Jurassic Park, wrote a novel called State of Fear, and the premise, has anybody read State of Fear? The premise of the novel was that this environmental organization, which was loosely modeled on the Environmental Defense Fund, now known as Environmental Defense, was going around the world and creating climate catastrophes as a way of fundraising, sort of scaring people into being worried about the climate. And that would have been fine if he'd stopped there, but his novel was full of footnotes. And he was trying to explain why, you know, his characters in the novel who were combating these evil environmentalists were actually correct. And you know, that, well, this scientific paper says thus and such. And so if you sort of think, well, okay, there's the IPCC report that says one thing and Michael Crichton that says another thing, and I think in the end, we scientists would have preferred that there was some kind of warning label on here. It's entirely fiction, okay? He was picking out select bricks from that pile and constructing his own little schoolhouse, which didn't use the whole pile of bricks by any means. So let's look at some real evidence. We know without a shadow of a doubt that Earth has warmed in the last 100 years. This is a record of the annual average temperature for the globe as a whole using both land and ship-based observations. And there's, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty in the exact numbers back here, but it's pretty clear that during the 20th century we had two phases of warming, one early in the 20th century and one late in the 20th century. The total amount of warming from beginning to the end of the century was about 0.8 degrees Celsius, or about 1.3 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's 1 degree Fahrenheit may not sound like much, but as we'll see, it's already having some fairly profound consequences. Of the last 10 years, five have been the warmest ever. 1998 was by far the warmest. That was largely because of the big El Nino event. But 2002, 2003, and 2004 were all in the top five as well, as was 2001. In fact, you can see that we haven't had a below average year since back around 1970. And this warming is clearly very steady, and also now exceeds the warming early in the 20th century. Well, this is having, as I said, some dramatic consequences, and even if we didn't believe what the thermometers are telling us, nature itself is telling us in new and dramatic ways. This is a series of satellite images from the Antarctic Peninsula, which is right here. So north is that way, and this ice shelf is ringed by mountains and islands, and it's about 4,000 square kilometers, about 2,000 square miles, so it's very big. And in the summer of 2002, it was an unusually warm summer, and it developed a case of acne or something. You can see these little black marks. Turns out those are meltwater ponds. Now this ice shelf is a couple hundred meters thick. It's several hundred feet thick, and it's quite old. It's fed by glaciers pouring out of the Antarctic Peninsula, and it takes a couple hundred years for the ice over here to drift over to the edge. Over the next few weeks, these pock marks, the meltwater ponds, percolated right through the ice shelf and weakened it to the point. Go ahead and loop through the next two images. Weakened it to the, and one more, to the point that most of the ice shelf collapsed. And this was the latest in, and most dramatic in a series of ice shelf collapses around Antarctica that are clearly linked with warming. Just to give you an idea of the scale of this ice that disappeared, it's larger than the state of Rhode Island. So this was an example of something that happened because of warming. Incidentally, in the 3 years since that happened, the glaciers feeding this ice shelf have sped up by a factor of three. So the ice in Antarctica is draining into the ocean faster than it used to. And although the ice shelf itself was floating and so wouldn't raise sea level, the accelerated glacier flow is raising sea level. Closer to home here, just a little bit west of here, in the North Cascades, is a glacier called the South Cascade Glacier. A little odd that that would be in the North Cascades, but in 1928 it had this inverted J shape, and in 2000 it had retreated substantially up the valley, leaving behind this meltwater lake. Old timers who have been here to Polden Village and hiked up to Lyman Lake have noticed the glacier up there receding as well, and it turns out my colleague Andrew Fountain at Portland State University, who studies glaciers, has done the most extensive survey of glaciers in the West that anybody's ever done, and he estimates that in the last 50 years the average glacier has lost about 20 feet in thickness. Obviously most of that is down at lower elevations, but it's very widespread, this shrinkage of the glaciers. And in another few years there will be a contest to rename Glacier National Park, because the glaciers there are disappearing and are expected to be gone within about 30 years. Did you have a question?
No.
Okay. All right. Another piece of evidence comes from measurements of snowpack conducted by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and its cooperators in order to predict summer stream flow. And they go up into mountainous areas once a month, typically March, April, May, sometimes also January, February. And they measure the amount of snow. And nobody had ever kind of looked at this as a climate record, but they're a unique record of climate in the mountains. And what's shown here are the trends. Each circle is one of these locations. And the reds are declines, and the blues are increases. And you can see that in the Northwest, there have been very few locations that have posted increases in this April 1st snow water equivalent, as it's called. And there's one measuring site at Lyman Lake, which has seen only a very small decline. Chris, the operations manager here in Holden Village, said he was very interested in seeing what climate change means for Holden's hydropower. And I certainly encouraged him to continue thinking about that. But the Cascades, particularly in Oregon, have seen some very dramatic declines on the order of 60 to 80%. Even some of these low elevation locations like Mary's Peak just outside Corvallis, nearly a 100% decline in the last 50 years. In other words, it used to commonly have snow on April 1st and now it hardly ever does. So it's pretty clear from the frozen world that warming is encroaching on the snow and ice of the planet. Now, I think there's no doubt that Earth is warming, so the question is, well, what about natural variability? And I can't resist talking about what I think is one of the most fascinating climate events and sort of geological climate events in the Northwest. In eastern Washington, there is this curious feature on the landscape that looks like rivulets of water. But they're on such a vast scale that people couldn't believe that it could actually be water. And there were erratic boulders found around here that originated up in the Northern Rockies. And it was a great puzzle how that could have come so far. But we now know, thanks to this satellite image and some very imaginative and careful geological work, we now know what caused these. And that is, at the end of the last ice age, as the Laurentide ice sheet was receding, a meltwater lake formed in what's now western Montana, called Lake Missoula, You can actually see the ancient shorelines, 1,000 feet above the valley in Missoula. Huge amount of water here. And it burst through an ice dam in northern Idaho. And this huge amount of water in this lake drained across eastern Washington and caused those scour marks that we see in eastern Washington. Backed up well up the Columbia Valley and the Yakima Valley, deposited a lot of silt and these erratic boulders, carved out dry falls, a beautiful spot if you ever get a chance to go there. And it plugged up at the Wallula Gap, which is what allowed it to back up here, and coursed through the Columbia River Gorge at speeds that they estimate of 70 miles an hour. Just imagine that huge wall of water traveling that fast, and just, you know, imagine the trees and everything that was taken along with it. And again, it sort of backed up as it got here and deposited more silt up the Willamette River. You can see all the way up to Eugene, 100 miles south of Portland. So very dramatic event, and this may have happened several times with the ice dam reforming and the lake refilling. So we know that there are these very dramatic examples of natural climate variations. How do we know that what we're seeing now is not just a natural variation? Well, there are several lines of evidence. The first is the basic physics, which I'll go over in a moment. The second is that this rate of change that we've seen in the 20th century appears not to be natural. The third is, and this is getting a little more complicated, but the pattern of change on the planet matches what you would expect from rising greenhouse gases. So it's what scientists sometimes call fingerprinting, that it resembles the pattern that you expect. And the fourth line of evidence is that if we actually calculate some of the major influences on climate over the last 30 years, the variability of the sun plus volcanic eruptions big enough to put ash into the stratosphere, we probably actually would have had a slight cooling in the last 30 years rather than the warming observed. So I want to go through a little bit of this evidence. This is a diagram of the global heat balance of the planet. And I want to draw your attention to two envelopes, if you will, or boundaries. The first is at the top of the atmosphere. All of the energy we get comes from the sun. And it doesn't matter so much what these units are, watts per square meter. Just think of this as like a family budget, money coming in, money coming out. 342 units that we get from the sun. Some is reflected by clouds. Some is absorbed by the ozone layer, as we discussed yesterday. And some is reflected by the surface. So in the end, the surface absorbs about half of the sunlight that's available. And this is averaged over the whole planet, night and day. Now, for the energy to balance, the amount going out has to equal the amount coming in. The only way the Earth can emit energy is infrared radiation, which is sometimes called long wave. And if you take 342 and you subtract the amount that's reflected, you get 235, so that's the amount of infrared radiation that Earth must shed to space. Now there's a simple formula in physics that says that the amount of energy output is related to the temperature. So all of us sitting in this room are emitting infrared energy, and we're emitting a little bit more than, say, the stone, which is cooler, and a lot less than, say, a light bulb. Turns out that the temperature the planet would have to be to emit that amount of radiation is a little less than 0 degrees Fahrenheit. So if we had an atmosphere that allowed the sunlight to pass right through and allowed the infrared energy to pass right through, that's the temperature that we would have. About 0 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, if you notice the thickness of these arrows, there's a great deal of energy being emitted by the surface, but it's virtually all stopped by the certain gases in the atmosphere, which we call greenhouse gases. These absorb infrared radiation. Oxygen and nitrogen do not. So you've got in the atmosphere these greenhouse gases that are stopping the energy from just escaping the space. Well, one consequence of that is that in stopping the energy, they themselves warm up. So the atmosphere is warmer than it would be, and it is capable of emitting energy in infrared, and it does. So it's emitting energy back to the surface. Now compare this number of the amount of energy we get from the greenhouse effect with the amount of energy that the surface receives from the sun. Notice that this is almost twice as big, actually more than twice as big. So what is important here? Well, the sun is important and the greenhouse effect is important. So how many people think that we can dial up the strength of the greenhouse effect indefinitely without having any effect on surface climate? No, it just doesn't make physical sense. And yet there are people who will claim that, and it's clearly wrong. Now, clouds and other things can sort of change the story a little bit, but it's clearly very important what is happening with greenhouse gases. So let's look at what is in fact happening with these two forcing agents. First of all, since late 1978, we've had a series of satellites, the names are shown here, measuring the actual solar output above the atmosphere. So we've had instruments on the ground, but they're, of course, subject to what actually gets through the atmosphere. And you can see this 11-year solar cycle, which you've probably heard of. But in fact, the difference between this solar minimum and this solar minimum is essentially zero, likewise with the solar maxima. So the solar output, we know, has really not changed in the last 30 years. Furthermore, this fluctuation of about one of these units is entirely in these ultraviolet wavelengths that are absorbed by the ozone layer. So none of that fluctuation is actually getting down directly to the surface. So over the last 30 years, we know that the solar output has essentially been constant, and it certainly cannot explain the warming. This is sort of a cool way to, it's rather complicated, but let me show you what this means. This is a way of representing carbon dioxide, the leading long-lived greenhouse gas, dating back to the early 80s. So this is latitude from the North Pole up here to the South Pole down here. This is time from the early 80s to 2001. And the rainbow color shows the amount of carbon dioxide. And you can see that in the Northern Hemisphere, there's this big annual cycle as the trees and the plants breathe in carbon dioxide in the spring, and then the leaves die and decompose, and the carbon dioxide returns to the atmosphere in the fall. But on top of this annual variation is this steady upward march toward the redder colors. There's also an annual cycle in the Southern Hemisphere that's much smaller because there's much less land life there to cause an annual cycle, and it's of course out of phase with the Northern Hemisphere. And you can also see that there's a little bit more carbon dioxide in the Northern Hemisphere than the Southern, and that's because we're digging up coal, oil, and natural gas, burning fossil fuels, and putting this carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and this is almost all happening in the Northern Hemisphere. That explains both the hemispheric contrast and the steady increase in carbon dioxide amounts, and we're now at amounts of about 380 parts per million. So we know without a shadow of a doubt that the greenhouse gases are increasing, and we also know that it's due to human activity for a variety of reasons, including this contrast. Okay, next. This is a longer-term look at carbon dioxide. Here are the direct measurements from Mauna Loa in Hawaii, which date back to the mid-1950s. To current values up here at 380 in 2005. Before those direct measurements, we can dig up ice cores and look at the actual air trapped in the ice and analyze its composition. And these are several different locations in Antarctica where that's been done, and they all have the same story, which is that before the Industrial Revolution in around 1800, there was essentially not much variation in the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Very natural balance between what goes in and what comes out. But as I said, we've started removing carbon from the rocks, from the Earth's crust, and putting it into the atmosphere by burning fossil fuels, and that's what's caused this 32% increase. Over the same time period, the climate record looks fairly similar. These various colored squiggles represent the efforts of various authors to reproduce the climate of the last 1,000 years using tree rings. I shouldn't say reproduce, but to represent the Northern Hemisphere average temperature. And you can see the warming shown by the thermometer record in this solid red curve here, and then all of these different efforts to represent the climate of the last 1,000 years. And it has that same appearance as the carbon dioxide, big increase at the end. And, you know, to be sure, there were variations in climate before this, but it looks as if this warming in the 20th century is faster than anything we've seen in the last 1,000 years. And it's also very likely that the values we now have for average temperature are substantially above anything in the last 1,000 years. So this is another piece of evidence that this is not just natural. If we go back on even longer timescales, we know that carbon dioxide and temperature are closely linked. This is the Ice Age cycles. Paleoclimatologists, for some reason, like to put now on the left and then go backwards in time toward the right. So this is basically the last 10,000 years over here, the previous glacial period, or the last glacial maximum, the previous interglacial period when there wasn't much ice on the Earth, and then the previous glacial period. So 140,000, 150,000 years of climate history. And what you can see is that if you do all these, if you normalize, in other words, make everything relative to its average value, the carbon dioxide and temperature numbers line up almost exactly, even for these little short-term spikes. So it just stands to reason that changes in the greenhouse effect and changes in climate go hand in hand. We know this over time scales of hundreds of years, thousands of years, tens of thousands of years. Finally, another way to look at the human role in climate is to take a climate model and do experiments. This approach, well, climate models are a little bit like weather prediction models. They represent the atmosphere as a bunch of boxes, and the air flows through the boxes as the wind blows, and then you can calculate, you know, how much radiation energy is absorbed, how much infrared energy is absorbed. If it rains, what the heat exchange is for that, the heat exchange at the surface, and you end up with this very complicated computer program that can simulate the average temperature of the planet pretty well, including where it's hot and where it's cold, the seasonal cycle, and so forth. So you take one of these things and you say, okay, we're doing an experiment with our planet. We're changing the amounts of greenhouse gases at a really good clip, as you saw. What happens if you do that in a climate model? Can it reproduce the experiment that we've done? So each of these panels here, the red curve is the observed climate history going back to 1860, which I showed you earlier. And the gray curves show a set of simulations with one of these climate models using, in the first instance, just the natural climate influences. The solar output, which, as you saw, is known very well in the last 30 years, and before that has to be estimated from sunspot numbers and that sort of thing, and also volcanic eruptions. And you can see that the average temperature would be, well, that it sort of bumps along with the average temperature, and then there are these dips every once in a while. There were a couple in the late 19th century, and then 1961, 1982, and 1991. These correspond to major volcanic eruptions. The latest of these is Mount Pinatubo, shot about 20 megatons of sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere, formed particles, reflected sunlight. Gradually these particles settled out, and that cooling effect was lost. So with each of these eruptions, you get a few years of cooling, and it shows up both in the simulation and in the observations. You see the dip here that corresponds with Mount Agung in 1961, El Chichon in 1982, and Pinatubo in 1991. So the models seem to reproduce the cooling you get from volcanoes when you do that experiment. But as you see, the last 50 years are kind of a failure in this simulation. What's missing? Well, obviously, it's the greenhouse gases. And if you just put in the greenhouse gases, The warming in the early to mid 20th century is not reproduced, but the warming late in the 20th century is. And if you put everything together, this model does a bang-up job of simulating the 20th century climate. Other modeling groups have replicated this experiment and they get the same answers, that you can only explain the recent warming if you include human as well as natural influences. So what we've seen is an emergence, and I think the comparison of these two diagrams really shows, we've seen an emergence of human influence on climate in the last roughly 30 to 50 years. All right, well, what about the future then? This is one image of future climate change. Anybody see this movie?
Yeah.
Anybody else see it but not willing to admit it? This was a sort of fanciful look at what paleoclimatologists call abrupt climate change. Now, when paleoclimatologists say abrupt, you have to bear in mind that they're used to dealing with timescales of thousands of years, and rather than 3 weeks or whatever it was in the movie. There was the tiniest grain of truth on which the movie was based, and that is that there's an ocean circulation known as the thermohaline circulation, and we'll talk a little bit more about that tomorrow, which in the past, during glacial times, has apparently been involved in some abrupt climate change in the North Atlantic region. There's no suggestion that the shutdown of the thermohaline circulation would suddenly cause New York to be buried in snowdrifts, half the size of the UN building. In fact, this is probably even more fictional than Michael Crichton's book. The starting point for talking about future climates is the rate of change of greenhouse gases, and the color curves here show the temperature changes that result from different assumptions about human socioeconomic development. The low end, the B1 scenario, assumes that global population peaks in mid-century and then declines, and it assumes that the developing world does not continue to grow at the rate that it's grown in the last 15 to 20 years. China has this astounding growth rate of I forget what it was, 6 or 8% per year, just really increasing their consumption of fossil fuels. And so this scenario says that China sort of cools down. It also assumes that there's a mass movement toward more environmentally friendly sources of energy. And this all assumes that there's no deliberate policy. We'll talk in a moment about international policy, but there's no policy active in this scenario. Well, that's the sort of low end. There are various high end ones, but the highest is this A1FI. Interestingly, it has the same population scenario, peaking in mid-century and then declining, but it assumes that China and the rest of the developing world continues to grow like gangbusters, and they're doing it all using coal. They just burn coal willy-nilly to produce electricity, and that fuels this rapid economic growth. You can see that in this B1 scenario, the global average temperature is almost leveling off at the end of this century, whereas in this scenario, it's still rising very rapidly. So we're talking about a changing climate during this century of somewhere at the very low end, 3 degrees Fahrenheit, which is almost three times what we saw in the last 100 years. That's the low end estimate. The high end estimate is 10 degrees Fahrenheit, which is almost 10 times what we saw, or 8 times what we saw in the last 100 years. So a very, very dramatic warming seems to be in the cards, unless we defy even the B1 scenario and rapidly turn away from fossil fuels. That's a subject for a little later. But global climate change is not about the global average temperature. I mean, who really cares what the global average temperature is? How many of you knew, for example, that 2004 was the fourth warmest year ever? Does it really matter? What really matters is more what happens locally. And in fact, global warming is not globally uniform. These colors indicate the amount of warming for one of these scenarios, the A2 scenario, which is kind of on the high end. The scale is shown down here. It's in degrees Celsius. And the Arctic is predicted to warm the most. And a lot of this is because with a bit of warming, the Arctic sea ice gets thinner or less extensive. And we've already seen this happening. And then once the ice is gone, it's not white, it's not reflecting, the ocean can absorb, and the ocean can exchange heat with the atmosphere. It's no longer being insulated. So there are all these feedback processes in the Arctic that make the warming greatest there. You can also see that the yellow colors, the sort of 3 to 4 degrees Celsius or 5 to 7 degrees Fahrenheit, are predominant over the tropical continents, and that the least warming is seen over the oceans. But even over the oceans, there's still a few degrees Fahrenheit of change. You can ignore all this squiggly blue and green contours. You also see, if you're from the Midwest, that the rate of warming projected for the Great Lakes area in Minnesota is substantially more than for the rest of the country. And you probably know that over the last 50 years, that's actually what's been happening as well, that despite a very cold winter about 5 years ago, I don't remember exactly when, one very cold winter out of the last 10. If you're from Minnesota, you probably remember which winter that was. But clearly things are changing and are predicted to change, and where you are depends very much on the type of changes that you'll see. Well, there's tomorrow we'll get more into the impacts of climate change, but here are just some reasons for concern, reasons that people have been anxious enough about this to consider crafting some kind of international policy. The first is coastal inundation. As we've seen, the glaciers are receding, and that water is going into the ocean. Greenland is melting around the fringes, and that water is raising sea level. Antarctica appears to be roughly in balance, but that could tip, and as we saw, there's evidence that the Antarctic Peninsula is contributing to sea level rise. But the warming of the ocean itself causes the ocean water to expand. So all of these things mean that the sea level is rising and will continue to rise. And so that's going to continue to inundate coastal areas. A second issue is water stress. As it gets hotter, water evaporates more easily. And so plants need more water in a hotter climate. Crops need more water. And that plays into what happens with predictions of agriculture, that tropical countries almost all see declines in agriculture in a hotter climate, even though the warming is less there. Up in Canada and Northern Great Plains and other places, a longer growing season could increase agricultural productivity for a while. So there's some of both. Can you go back? There are a lot of issues with human health, and we'll get to this in more detail tomorrow, but heat stroke is one example. Cold-related deaths is a counterexample of clearly a benefit of climate change. But one of the most troubling ones is things that we can't really manage, the natural environment, species either going extinct or changing their range, and ecosystems, which are assemblages of species, can also change. So for example, birds that are used to feeding on a specific kind of caterpillar, if the caterpillar is hatching earlier, and the bird is not, then they can become sort of disconnected. So a lot of reasons for concern, and that led to some efforts at international policy. Now, as we saw yesterday, acid rain and ozone depletion are relatively easily solved problems. With climate change, there are a lot more obstacles. The causes are systemic. This burning of fossil fuels to produce energy is very fundamental to development and to economic activity. There are no easy solutions, and there's no single culprit. You can't just sort of regulate one power plant and fix the problem. Now, in the crafting of international policy on climate change in the late 80s, the success of the Montreal Protocol at limiting ozone depletion was set forth as a model. The way it worked was the nations that signed on agreed to some initial fairly modest cuts. They were much more modest than some of the participants were proposing. But these modest cuts allowed some of these participants to show they were serious. And once they started showing they were serious, then a lot more nations signed on, and they agreed to deeper cuts. So they broadened the participation and deepened cuts. So that's a bit of background. In 1992, at a global conference on the environment, the Framework Convention on Climate Change was crafted. And its stated goal is to stabilize greenhouse gas concentrations at a level that will prevent dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system. In other words, it was recognized that left unchecked, this increase of greenhouse gases was eventually going to cause such serious problems that it could constitute dangerous. Now the policymakers, particularly in the US, said to the scientific community, tell us what level is dangerous. And the scientific community said, well, that's a social judgment. How many, you know, towns flooded by rising sea level constitutes dangerous? How many species gone extinct constitutes dangerous? And for years, there was essentially no response from the scientific community other than, we can't answer that question. Finally, about 4 years ago, you started seeing papers in the scientific literature trying to define dangerous. And in fact, there was a whole conference on dangerous climate change in February, called, incidentally, by Prime Minister Tony Blair, who's very interested in climate change. So this was a sort of backdrop, this notion of stabilizing greenhouse gases. And incidentally, this convention was ratified by the US Senate and signed by President George H.W. Bush. So it is official US policy to stabilize greenhouse gases in a way that would avoid dangerous anthropogenic interference. Now, we'll talk on Thursday about how well the US is meeting up to that obligation. The reason that this is complicated is that the inputs of carbon dioxide are very different from one nation to the next. The colors, this was a nice graphic put together by Time Magazine, the colors indicate the annual per capita emissions of greenhouse gases. That is, the amount per person. And so at a glance, you can see, well, the US, who's red? The US, Trinidad, where incidentally the head of my research group comes from, the most affluent Caribbean nation, a couple of Gulf states, Kuwait and the United Arab Emirates. They have lots of oil, so they can burn it to make everything, including water. They even burn oil to make water, desalination plants. And Australia, like the US, it's a country with wide open spaces, and people drive great distances, and it's fairly hot, and they use a lot of air conditioning. The plumes here show the amount of carbon dioxide that each of these countries has put into the atmosphere in the last 50 years. And guess who's number one? The US, by a long shot, substantially above the European nations, which collectively have roughly the same population. So in crafting international agreements, obviously you would want the biggest emitters involved, Australia, the US, these Gulf states, and Europe. But then you start getting issues about, well, what about these developing countries, particularly China, which is, it's currently not a big per capita emitter, but there are so many people that in 25 years it's probably going to overtake the U.S. in total emissions. So, what they ended up with was, just go ahead one. The Kyoto Protocol, which was a set of binding emissions reductions that was specific only to the developed countries. The European Union, which was more enthusiastic about this, accepted a target of 8% below 1990 emissions. So they're putting a certain amount into the atmosphere, and the goal is that by this commitment period, 2008 to 2012, their average emissions would be 8% below 1990 emissions. The US agreed to 7% below, and Japan, which already has a very energy efficient economy, agreed to 6%. Russia got a bonus of that they could be 10% above 1990 emissions. Just because they're a fairly poor country, but they wanted to be considered a developed nation. Now, if you could go back one, Yeah. Carbon dioxide is the most important, and you can't quite see the numbers here, that's unfortunate, but this is the amount of that additional energy, the watts per square meter, for each of the leading greenhouse gases. Carbon dioxide is 1.4 watts per square meter, so the current value, the current amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere relative to the pre-industrial. So this is the amount of the greenhouse effect. Methane is second. The CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, which we talked about yesterday, are third. Ozone in the troposphere is fourth, and then nitrous oxide, N2O, which is a byproduct of fertilization, is fifth. So in crafting international agreements, they recognized that there are all these different greenhouse gases, and they included a bundle of six, not ozone, because it's sort of indirectly produced. Okay, skip ahead two. Now, this is probably the most encouraging example of greenhouse gas emissions by any country. This is the United Kingdom. From 1990 to 2002, this is the Kyoto basket of greenhouse gases, and they actually saw a reduction beginning already in 1990, and they met their Kyoto target in the late 90s. So all they have to do is just sort of hold the course. Here is their Kyoto target, 2008 to 2012. All they have to do is sort of maintain where they are now. They have a separate goal of, a domestic goal of reducing carbon dioxide by 10% by 2010. Now, as we'll see on Thursday, the economic growth in the UK during this period was exactly equal to the economic growth in the US. So there are people who will claim that doing anything about greenhouse gases will wreck the economy. And I can virtually guarantee you that they have close economic ties to the fossil fuel industry, because that is the only sector of the economy that stands to be harmed by transitioning away from fossil fuels. Now, the way that the UK achieved this was not by anticipating the Kyoto Protocol and implementing the kinds of things they would need to meet the Kyoto Protocol. This was the consequence of Prime Minister Thatcher in the 1980s eliminating the domestic coal industry in Britain and transitioning to North Sea natural gas, to nuclear, wind, and a lot of other renewables. So it was, but she was a trained chemist, she was an academic. And somebody in the mid-80s went to her and explained this whole deal about climate change, and she got it. And she was on the international scene. She was the one pushing in the 1980s President Reagan and all the other leaders to start really addressing this. So she had that in the back of her mind in ending the coal industry. And it continues to be UK leadership. If you heard of the press coverage of the G8, where Tony Blair has taken climate change and aid to Africa as his two themes for his tenure as EU president. And he has used every trick he can think of to put pressure on the US. As I said, we'll get back to the US piece of this on Thursday. I think we're just about done. So it's pretty clear that Earth is warming as a result of human activities. We can no longer say it's all natural. We know that there's that the warming will continue for some decades at least. We've already committed ourselves to a certain amount of warming just because of the lag times in the climate system. There will be other important aspects of climate change. Shifts in precipitation, in storm tracks, may be very important. We can't predict them very well. Quantities of wind or storminess, hurricanes, tornadoes, there are a lot of important aspects of climate, and we can't fully predict what's going to happen, but clearly we're doing an experiment on the planet. Finally, this experiment can eventually be stopped, but it's not just going to happen on its own. We can't just sort of sit back and say, well, markets will solve the problem, and we'll just sort of gradually find our way to a benign climate. The amount of coordination on the international scene and with domestically among sectors, the tie-in to lifestyle choices, these are all very big and difficult issues. And we'll be getting into some of those later in the week. Thank you. Are there any questions or comments?
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
What's the other line?
Which other line?
The blue one.
This is the amount of carbon dioxide emissions by Great Britain. And this is carbon dioxide plus methane plus several others.
And why are the... What's the different units on the different side?
Okay, so this is million tons of carbon equivalent. So that carbon dioxide is carbon plus two oxygen molecules, and that has a greater weight than just the carbon. So this is the carbon, and this is the carbon dioxide. So they just forget what the multiplicative factor is. It's about three and a bit. Yes, sir.
We know that Creighton's book, for instance, was quoted in the Senate by a senator and used for political influential purposes.
Yes.
Are you certain that the panel of, what is it called?
The IPCC.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is totally scientific and there's no political influences there when you get to this review by peers and so forth?
The stage at which there's political influence is in the final round of review where governments can review as well. And it's interesting to watch that happen because all they can do is say, we don't like this statement. But if the scientists say the scientific literature supports this statement, they don't have to change it. An example was back in the very first assessment report in 1990, the representatives from Saudi Arabia, who were getting a lot of advice from some American consultants, tried to argue with essentially with every word in the summary that made it sound like scientists knew anything at all. And so there's a lot of sort of pushback to say, you have to be able to document what you say. I don't think there's really any pressure. Well, the only pressure to say more than we're comfortable with comes from the Association of Small Island States, AOSIS, which was a group that organized in the late 80s and are very vocal about climate change because they stand to lose so much. I wouldn't say that it's political meddling, but when we get review comments, it says, on this line you should say thus and such, or you should not use that word. And then we have to say how we responded to that comment. We can accept the comment, we can reject the comment, and then we have to give reasons, or we can do somewhere in between. But it's not, some of the things that are claimed about the IPCC or, about this cabal of sort of left-wing loonies who are trying to distort the science, that's not true. All the people who are involved are experts in the field. And if anything, are more cautious than not. Yes, ma'am.
Could you give some of the qualifications to the dangerous term from the science community that came out this February?
I think it remains a social judgment of what constitutes dangerous. But what is happening is people are trying to say, okay, if we get this level of warming, you're going to get this level of coastal inundation. And you're going to get this level of species loss. And you'll get this level of problems with agriculture. And so we're kind of trying to lay it out for a bunch of different metrics. And then, how on earth would you have a dialogue among the American people of what level actually constitutes dangerous? How many small island states going under is acceptable before you call it dangerous, and that's difficult. But at least we're some way along that route. James Hansen, who is known as sort of the grandfather of climate change science, argued that 1 degree Celsius was dangerous, and we're already at 0.8. And his reason for that was that by the time you get to 1 degree, you're melting a substantial part of Greenland. And that produces a certain amount of sea level rise. And you know, when you look at the areas that are flooded by even that amount of sea level rise, it's hard not to say, well, gee, if you live on Tuvalu, that feels dangerous. Hmm. So that was kind of his rationale.
Early on when you were talking about the energy coming in and energy out and the greenhouse gases reflecting back like the irradiated energy, mm-hmm. It would seem to me that they can only reflect back as much energy as we put up, or the energy that we, or the surface irradiates back up. Like it can't reflect more energy than we produce. So what do we do with models about that? And do those numbers increase, or how does that work?
Yeah, Nat, can you find that diagram? It was, roughly 10. Actually, just get to this, just do escape and get to the sorter and go up to the top. That was, roughly slide? 17. Yeah,
that one.
Yeah. So, the surface is certainly emitting a lot more than it's getting out.
Right.
And
what I'm saying is that only as much as we irradiate can get reflected back, right?
If there were another heat source for the atmosphere, can you go back? Stay with that one, Nat, go back.
Sure.
There would, but with some being lost to space, yes, there's going to be more going up than coming back.
Okay.
Is that your question?
I guess I'm asking, there's a limit to how much can be reflected back no matter how much greenhouse gases we get.
Well, the case of Venus is interesting. It's closer to the sun, so it gets more energy from the sun, but it also has a very high albedo, so it actually reflects something like 70% of the incoming radiation, whereas we're only reflecting 30%. The surface energy balance is entirely dominated by the greenhouse effect. The atmosphere is so thick and so cloudy that it essentially gets no direct sunlight, and its surface temperature is 700 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's an astonishing greenhouse effect on Venus, these numbers are factor of 10 more or something like that. It's very, very different. So that is a limiting case. I mean, if it got hot enough on Earth, all the oceans would boil, and water vapor is a greenhouse gas. So we'd have a super greenhouse effect like Venus. You had a question.
Have you, in your consideration of agriculture, you mentioned increasing temperature. Has your group considered the beneficial effects of increased levels of carbon dioxide up to agriculture?
Yeah, I'll talk a little bit about that tomorrow. But there's a whole mix of things, of course, that make agriculture productive. Longer growing seasons are clearly beneficial in most instances, provided the water is available. And so that's one issue is, is there enough water? And around here, where we rely almost entirely on snowmelt, that's becoming a bit problematic for main agricultural areas. The direct benefits of carbon dioxide fertilization, which you mentioned, really vary quite profoundly from one crop to the next. There are certain types of crops that respond very well to carbon dioxide, and there are other types of crops and plants that don't. It turns out that most weed species respond better to carbon dioxide than anything else. Some estimates say that just this 32% increase in carbon dioxide in the last 150 so years has produced weeds that are about 50 to 100% more prolific and more bigger leaves and so on. So there's a whole kind of mix of things. And then if you're a farmer, that one of the things that matters most is the sale price, which is determined largely by international competition. So around here, the apple growers in Wenatchee were devastated when China started growing apples. It had nothing to do with climate or anything else. The growing conditions here were essentially unchanged, but suddenly China was growing apples and eating up the, cutting into the export markets for Wenatchee apples. So, you know, you almost have to go place by place, crop by crop, to say, well, you know, better, worse. And yeah, so it's certainly a mix of that. You've
answered the question.
Okay.
But it's one addition about pollinators and the effect on climate change on the ecosystems and pollinators. And if a crop relies on a specific insect to pollinate and that insect is disabled or displaced by climate change, then the crop's not going to thrive.
Yep, another factor. And I realize we're over time, so I thank you all for coming and must adjourn. I